Any comments on that? Any lessons? Any takeaways? Anybody connect with that?
I think there's just some really fine lines there that I don't know about the rest of you, but I figure I'm crossing all the time, because so many times, like Saul says, I did something to bring honor and glory to God by making the sacrifice. And I think there's so many times we do things where we think we're doing something, the right thing, whether it's, I'm grasping at straws here, but the guy thought he was doing something good. I mean, but it wasn't quite
right
there.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but my toe's over that line all the time, I guess. I mean,
but
yeah.
Don't you think that God knew Saul's in his heart? You know what I mean? And, you know, Marianne, just because I think it's the heart's intent, you know, and you know, was he trying to really honor God, or was he trying to pacify God, or, you know, or bring honor to himself? You know what I mean? And that's a question that we, you know, we can't really answer.
Right.
But I would say, when you're doing something, you have to look and say, you know, why am I doing this?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the purpose of that? Not that you're, you know, a fine line that you might cross.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's a part of me that wonders, too, is, you know, when like Samuel finds out that Saul has set up a monument to himself, you know, you're talking about Saul's heart. In the midst of this apparent desire to please God by offering this sacrifice, we're also seeing that he's just as quick to set up some sort of tribute to himself as king. And, you know, I've wondered, I mean, again, we don't know, I've wondered in this story if Saul's intent was really to offer a sacrifice the whole time, or if that was just like the excuse he came up with when Samuel shows up and says, hey, what are you doing? You know, and I think I wonder if it's a public image thing. You know, Saul's trying to keep, you know, keep himself in good standing with everybody. But all that being said, I get what you're saying, and I think that it is hard, because there are times that we can easily cross that line without even realizing it, because it's like, well, this is an honorable thing. This appears to be a holy thing.
Yeah.
But I think when, especially here, when we see that Saul clearly knew what God had asked him to do, and he went the other way, but kind of defended it by saying, well, I'll honor God by going this way.
He was flat out lying to Samuel, because he fessed up and said, okay, so I did do that, but he fessed up and said, okay, I lied.
Yeah, the things that he did that just shuts me down, Aaron did it too when they made the golden calf. He did it. He didn't own his sin. When Aaron made a gold calf, he didn't own his sin. He said, those people made me do it. Saul said, well, my guys did it. I had anything to do. Well, if you're a commander, you've got a lot to do with it. And because it brings home, because we just listened to this talk a friend of ours gave. I guess in real life, he is a drug addict, because he never quit being one. And he owned that. I didn't become a drug addict because my wife treated me bad. I didn't do it because my kids were bad. I didn't do it because He said, I did it because I am, you know, and he owned that. Saul didn't own his sin. You know, I say Aaron didn't own his sin. And there's other, when David sinned as bad as Saul or worse, but he owned it. He said, God, it's my fault. And God says, well, I gave him, you know, gave him three choices. They're all against his people, not him. And he said, but no, it's my sin. Well, our actions of our sin are out bore by our friends and relatives more often than us. But it's not because we want it. It's because that's what happens when we sin. It's a disease that goes out. But we have to own it. We can't say, well, you know, I wouldn't have cheated my wife if she hadn't been... Okay, which I'm not saying that, okay? Well, but you know what I'm saying? How many times in life do you try to say, push your sin on... I wouldn't have sped if it hadn't been for that. Or, you know, I'm guilty. That's my worst sin, I think, speed. But, you know, say, you've got to own your sin. And Saul never did. You can't repent for something you don't own.
He says something like, you know, I've sinned, after he realizes everything's going to be pulled.
Yeah, he was sorry he got caught. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be sorry he sinned.
Yeah. I think Saul shows characteristics of lacking a backbone. Because in the first situation, you know, that he doesn't wait for Samuel. He panics because people are starting to leave him. So people are starting to scatter from him, and he doesn't have that control. And here you see he doesn't finish the job because of his army. Not because, I mean, he controls his army, but he's listening to what the soldiers are saying by taking them. And so here you're really seeing that he is not being obedient to God. He's being a people pleaser.
Right.
Because he wants to be king that everyone likes.
Yep.
And I think you can really see that contrast between him and Joshua. Because Joshua leaned on God for every battle. And so you see victory after victory after victory.
Right.
And he, you know, like him and Moses, they plead for the people's sin. They're not the ones who are doing it, but they're pleading for the sin of the people. Whereas here, you have the people who are sinning, blaming the other. So you kind of see that, like, 180 change of those who are obedient to God and those who are disobedient. And I think that that's the different and the characteristic of trying to follow God, is that they're self-seeking, whereas, like, Moses and Joshua were more God-seeking.
Yeah,
and so you have that contrast.
I'm taken by. We're going to switch to David now, because it's not long after this that David's anointed. He has to wait a long time before he becomes king, and go through a lot of hardship. But I do see Saul as a heart divided. Which actually, the divided heart ends in tragedy, real, really deep tragedy, and it's a long, ugly road there too. David is how? Let me see where I even want to go with this, because. One thing to just start with, when David is picked, it is where we find. Have you ever heard the phrase, "God looks at, or man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart"? It was when he chose David is when that verse happens. That's in 1 Samuel 16, verse 7. He said, don't consider his appearance or his height. It's like, we already crossed that. We have been there, done that with Saul. This time, I'm going for the heart. I'm going for the man who is actually, and David is called in a couple of different places, that he was actually a man after God's own heart. We can talk about what that means. But ultimately, he was young. He was ruddy. He was just a really, really healthy young guy. And he was the youngest. He was a shepherd. He was out tending sheep. And that's where God found him. And then he got famous through one fight. Isn't it amazing how just one good fight can put you on the map? If you come out on the right end. You know? It's amazing. Goliath. 40 days, every morning, every evening, this giant comes out and taunts the army of Israel. Let's not get all bloody and kill. Not everybody has to die here. Just send me one of your men, your best guy, and we'll fight to the death. If I win and kill him, then you become our servants, you become subject to us. If he wins, we become subject to you. This is a real simple game. And for 40 days, and someone did the math for me. That's 80 taunts. Someone want to do the hours for me on that? That, like, they were sitting there listening to this. Every person in Israel's army had good, long time to think, meditate, fast, pray about whether or not they're going to go risk their life against this guy who wears 125 pounds of armor and a 15-pound spearhead. His spearhead was 15 pounds itself. And everyone's looking to Saul. David comes with bread and cheese, bringing this to his brothers. His dad says, go check on your brothers, give them the bread and cheese, they like that, and just see how it's going at the battle. While he's there, he happens to hear the 81st taunt, or the 80th taunt, okay? And it's so amazing what his response is. It's just completely opposite of the whole spirit. I mean, he's looking around being like, okay, there's my big brother. I'm sure he's going to take care of this. Okay, maybe not him. Okay, well, the king. Who is higher than the king? He is surely going to take care of this. But there's no, everybody's just hush, hush. As this guy is just taunting Israel. And his response is, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Like, he's confused. He really is confused. Why this big guy is still standing out there taunting Israel? And as we find out, he's surprised because, in my opinion, he's surprised because he knows the living God. That's the only reason he's surprised. Because he knows who he's picking a fight with. He's like, are you serious? This guy? And the reason he knows the living God, he has seen what the living God can do. He's experienced it firsthand. These were gifts I believe God gave him that he probably didn't recognize them as gifts. When late at night, I don't care if it's in the middle of the day, there's a lion that comes and tries to take his father's sheep. Oh, great. I'm the shepherd. I got to deal with it. And he runs after it and prays, I'm sure, the whole time and kills the lion. Then another time comes where a bear comes and takes off one of his sheep. And he kills the bear. He had experienced the power of God in unimaginable conflicts already. And he tells Saul, this is a speech he gives him. He says, I had to deliver my dad's sheep from a bear. I killed a bear once, and I killed a lion once, protecting my dad's sheep. This guy's not going to be any different. I'm going to go take him down right now. And then Saul tries to give him, like, his armor and stuff, and it's, like, too heavy. He's, like, clunking around and stuff. And so he's like, this is no good. So he ends up just going out there. He doesn't have anything except for his slingshot, his good old slingshot that you know he's out there every day throwing against the tree. And 5 smooth stones from a brook. And what does he do? He gives him this speech after Goliath says, what, did you send a dog out here to fight me? Are you for real? A boy? Today I'm going to feed your flesh to the birds. That's what he says. David's response, and he is a teenager at this point. He is a young, young man. He says, you come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the, to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's. And he will give all of you into our hands. And what ensues is exactly that. He kills him with one shot. Then he goes up. The fallen Philistine is there. He takes his own sword out, cuts his head off, and grabs his head, runs on back to the king. He says, "Look what I found. You know, look what I got." This puts David on the map. And eventually, they're coming back after this battle is done. Word travels fast, and they're coming back into Jerusalem. And as they're coming into the city, there are ladies coming out into the streets, dancing and singing a song. And the song goes like this. Saul has killed his thousands, and David his
10,000s.
They were not singing that song as a slam to Saul. They were singing it as praise to Saul. But Saul didn't hear that. And Saul became jealous of David. And Saul begins to turn a jealous eye towards David from this point on in the story. And this is a very peculiar situation, because after Saul made his second big mistake, God took his presence from Saul and he replaced it with an evil spirit. We can talk about that in a while. But that would torment Saul. This is a very interesting thing, because his servants were trying to search for something that could relieve Saul's torment. Isn't it interesting that the only thing they were able to find to soothe Saul's heart was a harp, a harpist? And who played that harp but David? That was before David and Goliath. But after David and Goliath, he continued to play for him. Before David and Goliath, Saul allowed David to go back and forth to his dad and take care of the sheep and come back whenever he really needed him. At this point, after David and Goliath, after he kills Goliath, he no longer allows David to go home. He says, "You're going to stay closer to me." And he keeps that on, and he tries everything, slowly but surely, to get rid of David. And eventually just all outright kill him. From, what are some ways that he tried to do that?
He threw spears at David.
He threw his own spear at him. He said, "You want to become my son-in-law? The son-in-law of the king, that's great." Well, David's like, "I'm a poor man. I want to be able to earn this. You got to give me something that I can do to earn her hand." He says, "Very well. I want you to give me 100 Philistine foreskins for my daughter." That's crazy. It's absolutely sick and nuts. But, okay, no pun intended. But he does it. He sends him on military campaign after campaign in order, thinking that if I send him out on these campaigns, one of them's going to take David out. He's not going to be able to survive all of them. But what happens is the reverse. Every campaign he goes out to only builds his camaraderie with the men stronger, and he is victorious campaign after campaign after campaign. Saul begins to hunt David. David can't even stay in Jerusalem anymore. He leaves. Actually, does someone want to correct me on that? Is it Jerusalem that they're at? I'm kind of foggy on that. It doesn't matter. Wherever Saul's living, he can't live there anymore. Okay? The reason is because I know that after David becomes king, he takes over Jerusalem, and it's not an Israelite town. So, anyways, he can't even stay with Saul anymore. He's on the run. And Saul takes hunting parties out all over the desert, in the mountains, in the countryside, trying to hunt David down. And David, this is all after David had been anointed king. Now think about that for a second. David becomes king when he's 30. He's anointed king sometime in his teenage years. So there's at least a decade of time when he was anointed to be the king of Israel until he becomes king. He's anointed king, but Saul is left to reign. Saul is left going. He stays in office. He's not like God just moved him out or God killed him off or something like that. Nope. He still had another 10, 12, 13 years as king while David, and David had been told, you're the next king. You're my chosen one. But then what follows is nothing but fear and pain and ostracizement and excommunication and hunting from the current king, who really was like his, kind of like his, I wouldn't want to say his second dad, because I don't think that was the case, but I think there was a bond between Saul and David to some extent. Saul was like, David was like best friends, absolute best friends with his son Jonathan. There was a closeness there. And this man is trying to kill David. And he's spending a lot of resources trying to do it. And on two different opportunities, gotta mention these. David had, according to, you know, to his men, that God had given him, this is your opportunity to become king. This moment was given to you by God to end this wrongdoing and to take the throne. And he gave David two opportunities to kill Saul. What were they? Off the top of your head. The first opportunity happened when Saul was doing what?
Going to the bathroom.
He was going to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. He was in the mountains, saw a cave, wanted some privacy, went down to the cave, dropped his drawers, started going to the bathroom, and David was in that cave. David comes up, and he cuts off a corner of Saul's robe. Saul finishes his business, goes outside. David goes up around the other side, goes up on top to where Saul can't reach him. Says, hey, I want you to know that I could have taken your life, but I didn't because you're the Lord's anointed. Why are you doing this to me? And Saul's response is the same. I'm so sorry, my son. You're better than me. You're going to be king. I'm not. And he goes home. Second opportunity. Saul, he's like, he has amnesia. He comes out again trying to kill David on a raiding party. And this time, David does what? Anybody? He sneaks into Saul's camp. He actually goes into his camp. And he goes up to where Saul is sleeping. It says that the Lord put all the men in a deep, deep sleep so David could do this. And he goes in there, and he takes Saul's spear and his water jug that were right by his head. And he took those. He goes up where Saul can't reach him, gives the same speech. Saul says, you're better than me. I'm so sorry. You're going to have the kingdom. And that is, from what Scripture tells us, the last that Saul speaks to David. Because the next real story that Saul has is his own death. Saul dies on the battlefield, along with his son Jonathan, against the Philistines, I believe, in the end of 1 Samuel. I guess I just had a question for you. You know, have you ever felt like God has anointed you for a task that He's long and fulfilling in your life? Or has God ever put a desire in your heart that He's long and fulfilling in your life? I just have on here, as I was thinking about this, that oftentimes the weight and the hardship can be oftentimes God's greatest gift to us, because He's interested in character forming. He has great things planned for us, but we have to have the right quality of character to do what He's calling us to do. And he is patient. And He'll even allow us to break our ribs if it takes, to get us to the point where our character is at the place where we can do that thing that He put in our heart to do. And I see that as a real big life lesson from this portion of David. And I hope it encourages you. Because a lot of times it's just like, what are You doing, Lord? What am I doing? I thought, this is not what I thought life was going to look like. This is not what I thought I would be doing at this time in my life. David felt those things. Am I even going to live long enough to see what I had in my heart? There were many nights, I have to believe, that he questioned whether he would even see it or not. Because God is a God who sees things in eternal perspective, right? Maybe all men are like grass, and I am no different. David makes two big mistakes in his life. This is where I want to wrap things up tonight. His first mistake, his first big boo-boo. And before I go there, I want to say, it needs to be said, these days, after David became king, and the victories that he had, Israel had not seen any days like that before, and Israel has not seen any days like that since. Those were, for Israel, the golden era, where Israel was the superpower, where they were feared by all surrounding nations, where they had immense amounts of wealth, and they had peace in the land. This happened during and because of David's reign, okay? But pride often comes before the fall. And the scripture tells us, after these victories, when the springtime came and it was time for the kings to go off to war, David stayed home. Have you ever been in a place, have you ever not been where you know you should have been? This was David's place. Maybe he thought he earned it. Very well could have felt that way. And he's up on the rooftop one night. He can't sleep. And he goes out and he's walking around and he sees a beautiful lady baby. A lot of sensuality in the Bible. And he says, I want to sleep with that lady. Who is she? She's Uriah. She's your soldier's wife. Okay, well, bring her to me. Is a weak moment, and he sleeps with her, sends her home. She sends word to him, I'm pregnant now. He starts thinking to himself, trying to concoct a plan, sends for her husband, Uriah. And I'll tell you what, you need to read about Uriah. He is one of the toughest dudes, wisest in the military okay, in David's military. He's one of 30 men who are recognized above everybody else. This is no... He is a seal of seals, okay? He's no dummy. He brings him home, tries to... He gets him... He has him eat at his table and gets him drunk, sends him home, says, go sleep with your wife. Go enjoy the fruits of being home for the night, hoping that he will go home, sleep with his wife, and there's the baby, right? But Uriah, being a man of honor, knowing that his comrades are out in the field, will not leave the porch of David. He sleeps on the porch with the servants all night. David's like, are you serious? The next day, he does the same thing. Gets him drunk, gets him high in spirits, tries to send him home. He doesn't do it. The next morning, David knows what he has to do. He writes a letter to Joab, the commander, saying, I want you to put Uriah out where the fighting is the fiercest in the next battle. And when the fighting is the fiercest, I want you to pull back from him so he might be stripped down and dead and die. And that's exactly what happens. Uriah delivered his own death note to Joab. Nathan, the prophet at this time, goes and shares this news with David. And he tells a story about a rich man who has all kinds of flocks and herds, and there's a poor man who lives in the same town who has one lamb. And this lamb he cares for like it's his child. He takes it everywhere with him. He sleeps with it at night. He feeds it out of his own hand. And when this rich man had guests come to stay with him, he looked around for what to slaughter to feed to the guests. And instead of taking any of his herds and flocks, he sends someone down and say, go get that man's lamb. And he goes and he slaughters that lamb and feeds his guests. And Nathan says, what do you think about that man, David? And David is full of rage. He says, that man should be put to death. And then there's the famous phrase that follows when Nathan looks at David in the eyes and says, you're the man.